Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Kings chapter 17. I'm going to do the entire chapter today, verses 1 through 24. We will entitle this lesson, Elijah and the Widow of Zarephath. Our context is this. In our previous chapter, we looked at five kings of the northern kingdom of Israel, namely Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Omri, and Ahab. So now we're in the time of Ahab, which is when Elijah prophesied. Ahab ruled between 874 BC and 853 BC, and Elijah's right in that time frame. We start now in 1 Kings 17, 1 through 6. Now Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word." Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah, "Leave here, turn eastward, and hide in the Kerith ravine east of the Jordan. You will drink from the brook, and I have ordered the ravens to feed you there." So he did what the Lord had told him, Elijah did. He went to the Kerith ravine east of the Jordan and stayed there. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. Now here's a good introductory statement about Elijah from Adam Clark. The history of this great man is introduced very abruptly. His origin is enveloped in perfect obscurity. Who was his father, or from what tribe he sprang, is not intimated. He seems to have been the prophet of Israel peculiarly, as we never find him prophesying in Judah. A number of apocryphal writers have trifled at large about his parentage, miraculous birth, of his continual celibacy, his academy of the prophets, that he had no earthly parentage known to any man, that he was an angel of God, united for a time to a human body in order to call men back to perfect purity. Of course, all that is speculative nonsense. Some of it is, at least. We don't know where he came from. We do know he's from Tishbe in Galilee, and Tishbe actually is somewhat lost. People are not certain where it was. Now, Gilead, of course, is east of the Jordan, but BibleAtlas.org has Tishbe at the same place as Hazor, that place right southwest of Lake Hula, which is north of the Sea of Galilee. That same Hazor where the Jabin came from that fought Deborah and Barak. Well, if it's going to be there on the west side of the Jordan River, that's not in Gilead. NIV says Elijah is from Tishbe in Gilead, and Hazor is not in Gilead. However, there's another translation. There's a translation issue here. Holman Christian Study Bible translates it this way. Elijah the Tishbite from the Gilead settlers, which means that people would come from the east of the Jordan in Gilead and settle in Tishbe, also known as Hazor, on the west side. But at any rate, people don't know where Tishbe is. The Septuagint agrees with the NIV translation. It just says Tishbe of Gilead, which of course would put Tishbe to the east of the Jordan River. It doesn't really matter. Now, Gilead, as I said, is that area east of the Jordan River that runs from the south end of the Sea of Galilee to the north end of the Dead Sea. And basically, you can think Gilead. It's a rough geographical description of the tribal area owned by the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Half-tribe of Manasseh being to the far north, the Gadites being in the central part, and the Reubenites being down to the east of the northern half of the Dead Sea, and the southernmost part. Very famous area in Israel and Israelite history. Now in verse 1, Elijah said to Gilead, he said to Ahab, "Look, I'm passing this on to you. The Lord God of Israel is saying this. There's not going to be dew or rain for the next few years, except at my word." In other words, Elijah is saying, "I'm in control now. I have control over the weather. When I say it rains, it rains. When it doesn't rain, it doesn't rain." Now, of course, Elijah had to do that at the behest of God. He couldn't do it on his own motion. But as far as Ahab is concerned, this man has lots of power over him. We don't see Ahab repenting because it quit raining. So then the word of the Lord came to Elijah in verse 2 and verse 3. "Leave here, turn eastward, and hide in the Kerith ravine." Now, where is this Kerith ravine? That's somewhere to the east so that Elijah would be able to escape from Ahab, because Ahab's not going to repent. He's going to kill Elijah for bringing bad news. Kill the messenger if you don't like the message. Now, this Kerith ravine, nobody really knows where it is. Here's what Easton's dictionary says about it. It means a cutting, a separation, a gorge, a torrent beam or winter, a torrent bed or winter stream, a brook, in whose banks the prophet Elijah hid himself during the early part of the 3 years drought. It has by some been identified as the Wadi el-Kelt behind Jericho, which is formed by the junction of many streams flowing from the mountains west of Jericho. Well, that would put it on the west side of the Jordan, further down south as you head toward Jerusalem. Easton's continues, it is dry in summer. Travelers have described it as one of the wildest ravines of this wild region and peculiarly fitted to afford a secure asylum to the persecuted. But if the prophet's interview with Ahab was in Samaria and he thence from Samaria journeyed toward the east, it is probable that he crossed Jordan and found refuge in some of the ravines of Gilead. In my humble opinion, it seems to me that's probably where he went, back to his home stomping grounds in Gilead. The brook is said to have been before Jordan, which probably means that it opened toward that river into which it flowed. The description would apply to the east as well as to the west of Jordan. Thus, Elijah's hiding place may have been the Yarmouk River in the territory of the half-tribe of Manasseh. In other words, nobody knows where it is. Now, in verse 4, ravens are said to, or God says that, I will send ravens to feed you in the Kereth Ravine. The ravens brought bread and meat in the morning and evening. This is what Gil says, bringing up a little problem here. Unclean creatures by the law, these ravens were, since Elijah did not feed upon them, but was fed by them, and supposing any uncleanness by touch, the ceremonial law might be dispensed with in an extraordinary case, as it sometimes was, though it is very remarkable that such creatures should be employed in this way, which are birds of prey, seize on anything they can, live on carrion, and neglect their own young. In other words, they're bad birds. And yet these bad birds feed a prophet of the Lord, which shows the power and providence of God in it. Well, I don't have any problem with the fact that it was unclean animals that fed Elijah. But here's some other problems that Adam Clark brings up. Quote, if the flesh was clean which God sent, where could ravens get it? Here must be at least three miracles. One, to bring from some table the flesh to the ravens. Another, to introduce the ravenous bird to give it up. And the third miracle, to conquer the raven's timidity towards man so that it could come to the prophet without fear. Now, although God might employ a fowl that would naturally strive to prey on the flesh and oblige it, contrary to its nature, to give it up, yet it is by no means likely that he would employ a bird that his own law had pronounced abominable. Again, he could not have employed this means without working a variety of miracles at the same time, in order to accomplish one simple end. And this is never God's method. His plan is ever to accomplish the greatest purposes by the simplest means. And that is true. Clark is exactly right. If there are natural means available, God will use natural means. When the natural means expire, then God will use miracles. So he's got a point. But I'm going to say in just a minute that there's a problem with these complaints about this being ravens. I'm going to show you what Clark's solution to the problem is in just a minute. But first, let me put in bullet point fashion six problems that Clark has with this story. First, with what propriety the raven, an unclean animal, could be employed? Well, we've already talked about that. Two, why the dove or some such clean creature was not preferred? Well, that's just a variation on point number one. Point number three, how the ravens could get properly dressed flesh to bring to the prophet. Where did they find this meat? Number four, from whose table was it taken and by what means? Well, that's four, is just another variation of three. Five, whether it be consistent with the wisdom of God and his general conduct to work a tissue of miracles where one was sufficient. Six, and whether it be not best in all cases of this kind to adopt that mode of interpretation which is most simple, the wisdom, goodness, and providence of God being as equally apparent in those cases where a multitude of miracles are resorted to in order to solve difficulties. Well, six is just another version of five. So basically, there's three problems. Why would God use an unclean animal? Two, where did the unclean animal, the raven, get his food from? And three, why would God do all these miracles when he could have just done it more simply? Well, so here's how Clark solves the problem. He says that the Hebrew word could be translated as merchants. So the scripture would read in 1 Kings 17:6, the merchants brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening. The merchants did. Well, but here's the problem with Clark's solution. Are we really going to say that merchants would just toodaloo, go out into the wilderness with food for Elijah and Ahab's not going to find out about it and put a stop to it? Well, here's some other options as to what the word means besides merchants. Jerome, the great translator of the Vulgate in the early 400s, says that the word for ravens means Arabians. Arabians brought food to Elijah. Another solution that has been suggested is it's angels that brought the food to Elijah. Well, let me read you from Ellicott, who gives evidence in favor of the traditional reading of ravens. It was ravens who brought the food to Elijah. Quote, "Of the accuracy of this rendering, which is that of almost all the ancient versions and of Josephus, there can be little doubt. The singularly prosaic interpretations, substituted for the striking and significant record of miracle by some ancient and modern writers, adopting slight variations of the Hebrew vowel points, such as Arabs or merchants, I just mentioned those two, or such as inhabitants of a city Orbi, or inhabitants of the rock Oreb, is another optional translation I haven't mentioned. All of these seem to have risen simply from a desire to get rid of what seemed a strange miracle," continues Ellicott, "at the cost of substituting for it a gross improbability. For how can it be supposed that such regular sustenance by human hands of the persecuted prophet could have gone on in the face of the jealous vigilance of the king? But it is idle to seek to explain away one wonder in a life and an epoch teeming with miracles. It is notable, indeed, that the critical period of the great Baal apostasy and of the struggle of Elijah and Elisha against it is the second great epoch of recorded miracle in the Old Testament, the still more critical epoch of Moses and Joshua being the first. It is hardly less idle to determine that this or that miracle is so improbable as to introduce any difficulty of acceptance which does not apply to miracles in general." In other words, Ellicott is saying to Clark, as the same thing he would say to any skeptic. Clark is not a skeptic, but he's saying, look, if you're complaining about that because the ravens miraculously brought that food, well, why don't you complain about other miracles that you accept? There are miracles everywhere in the Bible. We're going to flinch at this miracle here? God can control ravens as to what they do. Now, concerning the problem of where this bread and meat came from, one commentator suggested it came from Ahab's table. That would be rubbing salt in the wound, adding insult to injury. Another suggestion is that the bread and meat came from the tables of the 7,000 who had not bowed their knees to Baal, the good guys, the Yahweh worshipers, wherever Elijah was supernaturally taken care of in the midst of this judgment. We go down to 1 Kings 17, verses 7 through 12. Sometime later, the brook dried up. That's the brook Cherith, where Elijah was being sheltered in. It dried up because there had been no rain in the land. Then the word of the Lord came to him, "Go at once to Zarephath of Sidon and stay there. I have commanded a widow in that place to supply you with food." So he went to Zarephath. When he came to the town gate, a widow was there gathering sticks. He called to her and asked, "Would you bring me a little water in a jar so I may have a drink?" As she was going to get it, he called, "And bring me, please, a piece of bread." "As surely as the Lord your God lives," she replied, "I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. I am gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die." Now this drought, this famous Elijah drought, I'll call it, 3.5 years, it's mentioned in James, 3.5 years of drought, actually is mentioned in profane history, according to John Gill. Quote, "Mention is made in profane history. Menander, a Phoenician writer, speaks of a drought in the times of Ithabalus, the same with Ethbaal, the father of Jezebel, which lasted a whole year, and upon prayer being made, there were thunder." Of course, that's only 1 year. This drought actually lasted 3.5 years, so I don't know if it's the same drought or not. So God tells Elijah to go to Zarephath. Where is that? If you look at the map, Tyre, which is right north of Acre, which is right north of Carmel, which is that little jut of land sticking out on the northwest border of Israel, sticking out into the Mediterranean. Zarephath is basically south of Sidon, a little bit close to it, but Zarephath is about 10 miles north of Tyre on the coast. Why did God ask Elijah, who was probably to the east of the Jordan, to go all the way over to the Mediterranean coast? Here's what Gill says. "This might be a trial of the prophet's faith, to be sent to dwell in a place belonging to the Sidonians, among whom Jezebel had an interest, being the daughter of their king." I would suspect that God is sending Elijah to the land of the Baal worshippers, Ahab and Jezebel. He's doing that so that Elijah can do his work. Good application point here is, if you want to do the work of God, sometimes God's got to lead you and take you to a difficult place. Now, this was definitely a trial of the prophet's faith. As one of my commentators said, that he should be sent to a poor widow woman for his support, and she a Gentile. But he that had been so long fed by ravens could have no reason to doubt of his being provided for in this way. He's leaving the land of Israel. He's going to the land of Gentiles. He's going to the lands of Jezebel's parents. He's going to a idolatrous land, a land that worships Baal and Astarte. He's going to a poor widow who doesn't have money and asking her for support. Plus, she's not even Jewish. She's a Gentile. That takes a lot of faith on Elijah's part. Now, here's an application point here. When the judgment of God comes, as the judgment of God was on the northern kingdom, there was a 3.5-year drought. When God's judgment comes, sometimes that requires people of God to be supplied in unusual ways. In Elijah's case, he was supplied by ravens and by a poor widow. It takes a lot of faith when judgment comes upon your friends, family, and fellow countrymen. That has a lot of relevance to America today, which I am absolutely convinced is under the judgment of God for our manifest and seemingly interminable sins. Now, the woman at Zarephath was gathering sticks at the town gate. Now, the fact that she was gathering sticks shows that she had no servant to help her, and that shows that she was poor. A widow was likely to be poor anyway, and so she was poor. And not only that, she was gathering sticks to make her last meal for her and her son. Now, in verse 10, as soon as Elijah saw her, he called to her, which means that God must have directed Elijah to say, "This is the widow I want you to ask to support you." So he tested out his idea that this is the widow. He said, "Would you bring me a little water in a jar?" Figuring if she said yes, that would be a positive sign. Now notice in verse 11, the widow had no trouble responding to that request. She went to get it. And as she was going to get it, which shows that she was a good woman, even in a drought, she's going to get water for a stranger who was thirsty. It shows her character. She looks at Elijah, realizes he's thirsty from traveling. No rain had fallen for a long time. He's in bad shape, so she's going to get him water, even though she's getting ready to die, getting ready to make her last meal. Elijah then, after asking for the water, asked the widow, "Bring me, please, a piece of bread now." That's a hard request to make to a poor woman in a famine. But Elijah was trying to try her, to test her, to see whether she was the person that God wanted to sustain him. Also, by asking, "Would you please bring me some bread?" that would lead the widow on to some more discourse with Elijah. Now notice in verse 12 that the widow swore by Yahweh. "As surely as Yahweh your God lives," she replied. That shows that was a common oath. People swore by God all the time. That's why whenever I see that in the Old Testament, I think about all those Amish who say that swearing is somehow immoral. False oaths are immoral, as Jesus told the Pharisees, but oaths that you mean by God? I mean, don't when you get up and get married, don't you swear by God that you're going to be faithful to death do you part? Well, her swearing by God shows that she was a devout woman, a lover of God. And verse 12 says, "I'm going to home to make a meal so that we may eat it for my son and me, and we're going to die." Now, you think, well, that's not so bad. It's like going to sleep. Oh, no. Dying is a very painful process. Starving to death is a very painful process. I looked at some information trying to make up some living wills for my mother, my wife, and me, and I discovered, after researching on the internet, that starving to death is awful. It's not easy. We go down to 1 Kings 17, 13 through 16. Elijah said to her, "Don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said. But first make a small cake of bread for me from what you have and bring it to me, and then make something for yourself and your son." Well, this was her last bit of oil and flour, and Elijah says, "Take from your last meal and make me a meal." Boy, that's a cheeky request. That, in fact, looks a little bit selfish to ask a woman dying from famine to feed the prophet first. She had to take food from her dying son's mouth. Well, the answer to that is this request of Elijah was not said from a selfish spirit of the prophet. He was trying to try the faith of the woman. She must have sensed that God was behind Elijah, and the fact that she agreed to what Elijah said. In verse 15, she went away and did as Elijah had told her. The fact that she took bread and oil from her dying son's mouth and gave it to Elijah shows that she was a true woman of faith, a godly woman. John Gill tries to justify Elijah by saying he was hungry and thirsty through his journey, and so it would only make sense that he was served first. Oh, come on, John Gill, please. I mean, Elijah was a stranger, and it was her son that she was taking food from. And they were dying of hunger. Compare that to being hungry from a journey. No, I don't think that there's any natural justification for feeding Elijah first. It was that she was an incredible woman of faith. Now notice Elijah said, please take from the last meal of your son and make me a small cake. It would have to be small because the widow was in the process of starving to death. Now Elijah says, don't worry about starving to death because the jar of flour will not be used up and the jug of oil will not run dry. And of course the application here is you give stuff to the Lord, Elijah representing the Lord, you give things to the Lord, God's going to multiply that which you gave, going to replace it, replenish it, and make it even more. And if you don't believe that, try. You get yourself in debt, try giving. Giving to the poor. Giving to spread the gospel. You watch and see if God doesn't heal your sick finances. Now notice that the widow just took Elijah's word for it when he said the flour will not be used up. She had no way of actually knowing that until she actually gave the flour to Elijah. And then she discovered, whoa, Elijah's word was true. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and her family. It kept being multiplied and they made it through the famine. It says the woman and her family. Some people speculate there were other kids available. I don't think so. I don't think so. She said she was making a last meal for her and her son. She would have said her family. She wouldn't pick out one son over another son. Now, this multiplication of food miracle is similar to other miracles of that type. Think of the manna in the wilderness. Think of the wine at Cana. Think of the feeding of the 5,000 and the 4,000 and the miracles done in the wilderness north of the Sea of Galilee. God likes to reproduce the things we need for our sustenance. We go to 1 Kings 17:17-18. Sometime later, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. He grew worse and worse and finally stopped breathing. She said to Elijah, "What do you have against me, man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son?" Now, sometime later, we don't know how much time later. We do know that Elijah parked himself there and was staying in the widow's house. And then the son, whose life Elijah had saved by getting God to reproduce food for that son, he dies. And so this is what the widow says. Why did you come to kill my son? Well, now that doesn't make any sense. Elijah had not come to kill the boy. He had come and saved the boy's life. Well, the woman was eaten up with grief. It was a rash statement. It was obviously said in the passion of the moment. Obviously, Elijah didn't have anything against her. And notice she says, Elijah, why did you come here to remind me of my sin? Why is she talking about her sin when her son dies? Well, because it's a common human emotion to feel guilty when calamity occurs. How many times have you done that? I've done it. Oh, my gosh. Why did I do that? Oh, things are going bad. It must have been my fault. I must have done something wrong to bring this on my head. Clark says that actually there could have been an actual secret sin that came to her mind. I don't think so. I think she's just feeling guilty. We go now to 1 Kings 17:19-24, and we will finish this audio. Give me your son, Elijah replied. He took him from her arms, carried him to the upper room where he was staying, and laid him on his bed. Then he cried out to the Lord, O Lord my God, have you brought tragedy also upon this widow I am staying with by causing her son to die? Then he stretched himself out on the boy three times and cried to the Lord, O Lord my God, let this boy's life return to him. The Lord heard Elijah's cry, and the boy's life returned to him, and he lived. Elijah picked up the child and carried him down from the room into the house. He gave him to his mother and said, Look, your son is alive. Then the woman said to Elijah, Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth. Verse 19, Elijah carries the boy up to his room where he was staying in the upper room. Why did he do that? So he could be alone with the son, away from the grief of the widow and her crying and her hysterics, so he could better concentrate while he was praying. Now Elijah says to the Lord, Lord, why have you brought tragedy upon this widow? Why would Elijah think God did that to the boy? Well, it's clear to me that the prophet Elijah doesn't think the way modern Christians do. We are very scared to ascribe bad events as being ordered by God. But the Old Testament people had no trouble with that at all. God was in sovereign control of everything, including a boy dying. Now, of course, I guess you could say Elijah was wrong to pray that way. The Bible doesn't say that he was correct in saying that. But he was a man of God, an incredible prophet, and he didn't have any trouble praying that way. Why have you done this? Notice in verse 20, Elijah says that he's staying with this widow. He said, why did you bring this tragedy upon this widow? I am staying with. In verse 19, he carries the boy to the upper room where he was staying. Think about this. A single man, Elijah, is staying with a single woman and living in the same house with her. That doesn't look good to me. But of course, there are cultural factors here. I learned this by going to China. It was just amazing to me how many men and women stayed in the same house, the same hotel rooms, the same apartments, and they were living platonically. I could tell you a bunch of stories about that. And so I guess if your culture looks at that, and I guess you could look through the eyes of your culture and say, well, they're not living together. He's too holy for that, or she's too old for that. Well, she had a son, so she wasn't that old. It just didn't look right, it would seem to me. But hey, let me give you the story in China one time. I was giving a seminar talk, illegal, had about 150 students in a university in Shanghai in the room, and I was talking to them about the evils of living together before marriage, which of course is very popular over there as it is here, and I was telling them all the horrible things that might happen. And finally, this at the Q&A time, a young girl in the back of the room raises her hand and she says, well, what if you're living together with your boyfriend and you're not having sex? And I went, well, that ain't going to happen. Later, I found out this girl goes to the Chinese teacher who had asked me to teach, to speak, and she said, he's a foreigner, he doesn't understand. He says, we do this all the time. And at the time, I didn't realize it, but from other experiences I had later, I realized that that young girl was exactly right. Happens all the time. I remember one young lady who was my tour guide, and she was a very moral person. Her father had raised her in the code of Confucius. She was not a Christian. She was living with her boyfriend, and I assumed what I normally would assume. And then I got to know her pretty good, and I found out that she was living platonically with the guy, an American guy, which makes the miracle even more miraculous. And I said, well, how do you do that? She says, very simple. I just put a row of pillows right down the middle of the bed, and I tell him he cannot cross over. And I thought to myself, oh, is China a wonderful place? Only in China could I hear a story like that. I could tell you some more, but I'm not. I'm going to move on. I'm going to assume that this was not a hindrance or a bad testimony to the people of Zarephath seeing Elijah, the Yahweh prophet, living with a single woman. Now, let's look at verse 21. Elijah stretched out over the dead boy. Let me read what John Gill says about that. Putting his, Elijah's, mouth on the boy's mouth, Elijah's eyes on the boy's eyes, Elijah's hands on Elijah's hand, Elijah's hands on the boy's hands, as Elisha afterwards did in a like case, perhaps in imitation of him, thereby showing Elijah's great affection to the child, and in order to increase it the more, and to make him the more fervent and importunate in his prayers for his life, and hereby signifying also he would, if he could, infuse his breath and life into it and warm it with his own heat. Well, Gill emphasizes the fervency of Elijah's prayer by lying on top of the boy and breathing into him. That would show how much he wanted that boy to come to life. I think it could be symbolic. You breathe. Breath is symbolic of life. You can't live without breath, and so Elijah's breathing breath into the dead boy, it was a symbol. Prophets love symbols. Now, Gill mentioned that the same sort of incident happened with Elisha, not Elijah, but Elisha. In 2 Kings 4:34, we read that. Then he, that's Elisha, went up and lay on the boy, that was the dead child of the Shunammite woman. Elisha put mouth to mouth, eye to eye, hand to hand. While he bent down over him, the boy's flesh became warm. Very similar type situation. How about in Acts 20:10? Paul went down. This is when he was at Troas and on coming back from the third journey, and Eutychus fell out the window and was dead on the ground, and Paul went down, fell on Eutychus, embraced him, and said to him, don't be alarmed, for his life is in him, and said, don't be alarmed, for his life is in him. Similar type story. You fall on dead people and breathe life into them. Here's what Clark says. It is supposed that Elijah did this in order to communicate some natural warmth to the body of the child, in order to dispose it to receive the departed spirit. Elisha, his disciple, did the same in order to restore the dead child of the Shunammite. And St. Paul appears to have stretched himself on Eutychus in order to restore him to life. So there's two aspects here. The symbolism, well, actually more than two, maybe three. One is the symbolism of it. Two is warming the body up so that it could receive life. And three, to show how much you cared, how passionate you were to see that the boy is raised from the dead. Now in verse 22, we read this. The Lord heard Elijah's cry, and the boy's life returned to him. That shows that he was dead, because if life returns, that means life is gone. He was dead. It also shows that the soul does not die with the body, but exists in a separate state without it, because if the boy's life left, the soul had to go somewhere, and then it returned. He probably had a near-death experience. I wouldn't doubt it. So Elijah picks up the child, carries him back downstairs, gives him to the widow, and the woman says to Elijah, "Now I know that you're a man of God." Well, you would think that eating miraculously for a couple of years with multiplied food and oil would have already convinced her that Elijah was a man of God. But this really convinced her. This actually is the first instance ever in Scripture of someone being raised from the dead. Well, ladies and gentlemen, with that triumphant note, we have now finished 1 Kings chapter 17. That prepares us to go in our next audio to 1 Kings chapter 18, all 19 verses, and we will see Elijah confronting the curmudgeonly idolatrous Ahab. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.